Third argument to be argued today is docket number 23-1348, Unification Technologies versus Micron Technology. Mr. Rastegar?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, please begin.
May it please support John Rastegar on behalf of the appellant, Unification Technologies. Director Vidal's prior authorship and endorsement of the petitions at issue in the IPR created a unique circumstance that deprived UTL of due process. As the director of the PTO, the director serves as the boss of all the employees there, including the APJs. She controls the careers of the APJs, she controls case assignments, performance reviews, and compensation.
How do we know all that?
So from both Arthrex and Mobility Works, Your Honor, the case law there details at a high level the compensation structure for the APJs.
But as a practical matter, none of those opinions make any comment on whether or not the director of the agency is looking through, I don't know, 250 different administrative patent judge performance reviews and then making some kind of assessment on what's the proper bonus amount, if any, for those people, as well as thousands of other employees of the agency.
So, respectfully, it's not necessary to show that the director personally reviews each of the APJs for this compensation. It's sufficient for the director simply to oversee the entire compensation structure, because the director can instruct her subordinates to award compensation based on aspects like performance, and she can single out individual APJs if they've caught her attention.
So, what about if there was a patent reexamination here? Would that also be barred from consideration, because that would necessarily require a PTO employee to undertake that re-exam, and that employee would necessarily be under the control of the director, or at least the director would be reviewing bonuses?
So, if I'm understanding the question correctly, Your Honor, you're asking if the director petitioned for patent re-examination, would the same concerns apply?
Yep, right.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe they would.
Okay, so then there's really no way for this agency to do any kind of second review of your patent so long as Director Vidal is the director, even if she recuses herself.
Well, as an initial matter, the petitioner here always has the remedy of using district court to challenge the validity of these patents, so the petitioner is not being deprived of the right to challenge the patents. Mm-hmm. The fact that this particular avenue might be foreclosed by the fact that the director is currently overseeing the employees within the patent office.
So the answer to my question is yes?
I think as long as the compensation structure is as it currently is, the answer
which is
yes.
What?
That the director has control over the discretionary components of APJ compensation. In particular, those components include...
And I guess patent examiner discretionary compensation.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not sure if the director has control over patent examiner discretionary compensation.
How do we know they have control over the discretionary compensation for APJs then?
So, again, in both Arthrex and Mobility Works, the compensation structure was detailed, and I believe in Mobility Works, it was detailed that among the factors considered in the discretionary review were decisional units, which are an objective criteria, but then several subjective criteria, including support for PTO leadership, quality of work, and stakeholder interactions.
The PTO's intervener brief here doesn't say it, but the PTO's brief in Mobility Works noted that it's lead APJs that do the performance reviews for APJs. So that seems to be something of a roadblock for your position that it's always the director that's responsible for this.
Respectfully, all of the APJs at the end of the day are subject to the director's feedback and review.
Then it would be the same for patent examiners as well.
Again, I'm not particularly familiar with the patent examiner compensation piece. That's why I said I don't know. I only know.
It seems like the logic of your position is that because of Director Vidal's past, your client is absolutely immune from any adverse action at any level by the PTO until she leaves as director.
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Only for situations where the director endorsed and authored the arguments that are being presented to the Patent Office. So if
the director had taken all these exact same positions against your client's patent, but they were in a district court filing, and you're saying, okay, that's not enough because it wasn't actually filed here, that this agency.
Correct, Your Honor. The issue is that the arguments of the director are being presented to her employees, and they're being asked to sit and adjudicate fairly their boss's arguments.
So basically the extension of what my colleagues have been asking is essentially a person who practiced before the PTO should never serve as director of the PTO.
No, Your Honor, not at all. What we are saying is in a situation where an individual is on the short list, for instance, to be considered for director, they should make a calculated decision to not put their name on a petition.
You're a nominee doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be confirmed, right? So you're basically asking her to quit her job, hoping that she'll be confirmed. Is that kind of what you're saying? I don't know if I'm misunderstanding your argument. I'm trying to get it.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that's not what we're saying. What we are saying is that everything that Ms. Vidal did in private practice could have been done without affixing her name to the petition here. There are associates certainly at the firm who work on petitions who don't have their name on the briefings.
Wait, so you're saying it would be okay if she had kind of secretly been working on this stuff, but you have more of a concern because she actually put her name on the briefing and then appropriately recused?
Yes, Your Honor, we have a concern that she put her name on the briefing because as a result of putting her name on the briefing, it became a matter for the APJs to then have to consider. They knew they were considering their boss's arguments. If she never appeared on the briefing, this wouldn't have been an issue.
Do you also have a concern about the timing of the withdrawal from the IPR proceedings by Director Vidal?
We do.
What's the concern?
Respectfully, had she withdrawn the moment her nomination was announced, this would have been a much different factual scenario. Instead, Director Vidal was lead counsel on the petitions, and then the replies were filed. After the replies were filed, Director Vidal withdrew from this case.
But the petitions have been filed before her nomination.
Correct, Your Honor.
And she authored the arguments and her name was on the brief. Why wasn't that enough from your perspective to be a disqualification?
So the reason it would be a different factual scenario is that it would have at least signaled to the APJs that the director is trying to withdraw herself from this process to avoid any sort of potential for improper influence.
Well, if it's possible for her to cure this sort of defect, then I'm unclear on what she failed to do here that you think was necessary to cure the problem.
Because in this instance, the director waited until after the reply was filed to withdraw.
So to go back to what Judge Cunningham said, your position is once you know you're being considered, if you've practiced in the PTO, you know you're being considered for a nomination, you better right now withdraw from everything that you're working on in the PTO. Otherwise, you're going to inadvertently immunize a certain number of patentees from ever being subject to an IPR.
I think the prudent course of action would be to not continue to put your name on new filings.
Can I ask you if something that confuses me is, well, I understand you would prefer that we reverse what the board did here. You do say, or alternatively, vacate and remand the board's final written decisions. Who would you have us remand this case to?
So, again, the director controls the compensation structure for the APJs. If the director removes the subjective components that are, you know...
So you want us to vacate, remand, and order her to revise her compensation structure?
No, we would... Well, ideally, we would like you to reverse. But if you were to remand... If you were to remand to the PTAB, then I believe the PTAB has a choice, right? They can either have certain APJs who are not subject to any sort of subjective analysis of their performance.
If they use their current APJs under their current compensation structure, then our remand is just inevitably going to lead to you coming back here and saying we need to, that whole thing was tainted and we can't affirm it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So if the director issued, I don't know, some statement today that says
you know, I do not ever look at bonus compensation for APJs. But let me be very clear that if this case ever comes back on remand to the board, I am completely walled off from any kind of performance review or bonus decision making for the board panel. Would that be good enough?
Potentially. Again, the test is not whether or not the director actually biased the process, but whether an average APJ would be tempted to consider her role as director and as the author of this petition in analyzing facts and reaching their conclusions. You know, if there was a strong enough statement, I believe that would potentially help cure this issue.
That's one question on the merits. Your position is we don't have any claim construction dispute in front of us. It's all just, it seems to me, a disagreement with how the board read this Suda reference. Is that right?
That is true. What I would say is that our position is the claim terms needed to be afforded their plain and ordinary meaning, which means that the words we...
And they were not? Or they were?
They were not.
So that is a claim construction dispute.
I think it depends on how you characterize that. I think the two big issues there that pop up are that we believe the claims of the 658 and 406 patent, which require an indication or message that data has been deleted or erased, have a past tense component to them, and that carries a meaning that should be respected. I don't know if that necessarily rises to a true claim construction dispute as much as we just don't feel that language was appreciated by the board. Similarly, with respect to the marking module in the 406 patent, it needs to act in response to receiving an indication, or the indication rather. Again, this goes back to, this needs to be the same indication then that the request receiver module received, and there needs to be a recognition of that requirement in the claim language. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time.
Okay. We'll keep your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. My understanding is Ms. Coverley for Micron is going to argue first? Is that
yes,
right?
Your Honor.
Okay. But given the way that the oral argument has gone so far, I would imagine that you'll be using much fewer than 12 minutes and giving the government more than 3 minutes to respond to these due process arguments. But feel free to also give your 2 cents on the due process argument as well.
I will, Your Honor. Obviously, we think there is no, and may it please the Court, obviously, we think there is no due process problem here. In fact, we think that unification's argument, taken to its logical extension, doesn't solve the due process problem. It actually creates one. The relief that unification is asking for here is a ruling that would deprive my clients of the right to pursue any relief whatsoever in front of the Patent and Trademark Office just because the counsel they started with happened to later be selected for a presidential appointment. Accepting that argument would create tremendous unfairness for my clients. And why do that when there's no evidence that unification suffered any unfairness at all? As we heard this morning, my colleague here has conceded that there's no evidence in the record that shows that the director personally decides the bonuses for APJs. The record is devoid of that. And when you ask about the record evidence and the basis for finding compensation, the only citations were to Mobility Works.
The director sets the pay for the APJs, right?
The director sets the rate of pay for the APJs. There is a bonus procedure. According to Mobility Works, the bonuses are decided in a performance review that may include things like quality, productivity, and advancing the mission of the PTO and its leadership.
But that is
not tied to outcomes, right?
Obviously. It's not tied to outcome, and it's certainly not tied to fidelity to a position that the director took before she was the director while she was in private practice on behalf of a client. It is extremely far-fetched to say.
The question, though, is you know, maybe you can't unring the bell once the APJs are fully aware that the director has, in fact, filed something to the board, taking a very, very specific position in this proceeding, then, you know, it at a minimum, it creates an awkward situation for an APJ to potentially knowingly and publicly take a position that's contrary to the current director.
So, Your Honor, my colleague a moment ago said repeatedly that she put her name on papers filed in this IPR while she was a candidate. She did not. The petitions in this case were filed before Director Vidal was nominated. In fact, the petitions, the IPRs, were instituted before Director Vidal was nominated. Once she was nominated, the only thing she put her name on in this case was a motion to withdraw. She did not put her name on the reply briefs that were submitted before her confirmation hearing.
She had not withdrawn yet.
She had not withdrawn yet, but she did not sign any papers or any arguments once she was nominated. And that was a very significant part of the argument I just heard. The argument seems to be that people in the world might think that administrative patent judges might fear that if they rejected an argument on that was being asserted by one of Director Vidal's former clients, that she would take it personally, would personally involve herself in their compensation, and would punish them through the bonus. That is the very definition of speculation. It is extremely remote, far more remote even than the argument about institution bias that this court rejected in Mobility Works. And where would that argument end? I mean, there's no logical...
Because there was at least an argument made by opposing counsel in terms of a concern about the timing. I know you're addressing that in some parts, but what do you contend is the appropriate time by which she would have needed to withdraw?
It takes a long time to go through a nomination hearing, as I'm sure all of you are painfully aware. And I don't think there's certainly nothing in any rules, in any case law, in any precedent that requires a candidate to immediately drop their practice completely as soon as they are nominated. So there's simply no requirement, no expectation that I've ever heard of that that is what is required. She did withdraw before her hearing. She certainly withdrew before she was before she took office, and she recused before the moment at which she would have been required to be involved in any sort of decision, in any director review petition. So there was no delay here. She acted prudently and quickly, and there's simply no rule or requirement or anything that I've ever seen that would require her to act differently than that.
I don't think have any evidence that she could have been or was involved in any compensation decisions in that time before she recused herself.
Correct? I think that's correct, Your Honor. And also, and I think this is important, it would be inappropriate for the director to take it personally if one of the deciders in an IPR rejected an argument she liked. And what would be the limit of that? Why wouldn't the same argument apply if she made an argument in litigation on behalf of a different client, or if she made a speech, or if she wrote an article? And the argument we're hearing today would essentially...
I guess the subject is not so much her, it's the APJs that were on this panel, and what's their perception, and their likelihood of feeling some kind of pressure to be biased.
There has been no evidence presented here to suggest that an APJ would have an expectation that they would be punished by the director for ruling in a particular way on a particular IPR. There's simply no evidence in the record to suggest that. It's pure speculation. And it's certainly not the kind of evidence that one would expect for the kind of request we're hearing today, which is essentially to disqualify the entire Patent and Trademark Office from addressing any issue on which the director personally took a position, whether herself or on behalf of a client while in private practice.
Is there anything you want to say briefly on the merits based on what you heard this morning?
There is, Your Honor. There is no claim construction issue being presented here. If you look at the opening brief, you'll see that in every, if you just look at the table of contents, the heading of every section is
Well, we have to figure out what is in response to receiving the indication mean, right?
Your Honor, the there's a footnote in which the footnote 6 of the board's decision explains that this idea that there had to be something that happened directly in response to the initial indication was something that was argued for the first time at oral argument below, and no evidence was presented to support it, and the court did not consider it. Moreover, there was another basis for the board's ruling. And the board concluded that SUDA discloses things happening in response to an indication. The whole point of what SUDA was describing was the user of the host chooses something for deletion, let's say a picture in a digital camera, and the host computer does two things at the same time. It sends an indication that information has been deleted, and it also removes things from the host computer's file system. And then once the indication goes to the SSD, things happen in response, including the information on the non-volatile storage is marked as something that could be erased or recycled or deleted in whatever fashion the algorithm concludes. So there was the very extensive factual findings made here, Your Honor. And one thing I have not seen, either in the briefing or even in oral argument here, is any suggestion as to why the evidence presented to the board was insufficient to support the conclusions that the board raised. The decision about what a prior art reference discloses is the epitome of a discretionary a decision that this court reviews for substantial evidence. It is a factual issue. And there have been no claim construction issues. You will, if you review the briefs, you will not see a single reference to a statement the board erred in its claim construction. That is not part of the arguments that have been presented to this court. And the same is true for the motivation to modify, Your Honor. The board concluded that there was no motivation to modify required here, and as a result, it did not need to consider that issue. No modification was required.
Okay, thank you. Let's hear from the PTO.
Good morning. May it please the court. Rob McManus for the government. Let's start with the timing of the withdrawal and the recusal. As this court's questions recognize, there is no conflict here until Kathy Vidal is actually confirmed as the director. That is the nature of the argument from appellant as to why these APJs may be concerned about reaching a particular outcome. They want to make their boss happy. She's not the boss until she's confirmed. She's confirmed on April 5th, 2022. By that point, she has withdrawn from the district court litigation, and she has withdrawn her representation in the IPR. She has also, since the point of her nomination in the fall of 21, never filed a paper in the IPR. So we have no indication that she has participated after her nomination, which arguably does not even create a conflict per Judge Cunningham's questions. She's still, I don't mean this pejoratively, she's just a Winston & Strong litigator at that point. She is an attorney. She is, as you all know well, the nominations process may not bear fruit, and it's certainly the timing of which is unknown even to the nominee. So under those kinds of facts, it would be an extreme remedy to grant appellant's request to issue a ruling that the PTO could not entertain any review of this patent in this IPR, or as Judge Chen recognized, in re-exam. It also has profound effects for whether the degree to which the PTO can examine applications from entities for which the director has a conflict. Those issues counsel for this court to reject the invitation by appellant to craft the remedy. We also know...
The argument is, from the other side, that the director holds the strings when it comes to bonus compensation decisions. And so, therefore, it's really that. Mm-hmm. Regardless of the timing of recusals and withdrawals and things like that, ultimately, it still boils down to the fact that, in reality, she holds the strings to these APJ's bonus compensation decisions. And that is the trigger that would or could likely induce an average APJ to try to do something to make their boss happy as opposed to unhappy.
Mm-hmm. Well, as Your Honor pointed out, the bonus structure that this court endorsed in Mobility Works is not rising to a due process violation, even accepted on face value, that there might be some relationship between a particular decision and the bonus, recognizes that those bonuses are administered by board management. The structure that is outlined in the standard operating procedures for the board on how these bonuses, which are discretionary, are administered, does not contemplate any involvement from the director. Could the director get involved? I mean, ostensibly nothing forecloses the director from doing so, but there's no reason to think in this particular instance that she would do something that she normally does not do and insert herself into the particular bonus compensation for these particular three APJs. And that issue aside, we're still back sort of at square one with the issue that was addressed in Mobility Works. There it was about institution decisions, and here we're talking about final written decisions. But the argument is the same, that APJs care about a particular outcome, and that particular outcome drives their bonus incentive. Well, this court rejected that in Mobility Works, and it's equally applicable here. There is no correlation between the particular outcome of a decision and the APJ's particular bonus, and particularly when you consider in the context that each one of these decisions is what they call a decisional unit. The APJ's bonuses require 84 decisional units. So the idea that one would stand out amongst the other 83 or however many they've acquired is tenuous at best. And the Van Harken decision, which this court cited to in Mobility Works, puts a fine point on sort of the real basic argument that's at play here, which is I want to make my boss happy, and so I might do something that I think is going to make them happy. That Van Harken decision from the Seventh Circuit rejected that premise as highly tenuous. The idea being, there the argument went, this particular individual would find violations in order to make their boss happy, lest their boss fire them. Now here, APJs are not at-will employees, so Director Vidal does not have direct ability to terminate an APJ based on a particular outcome of a decision. But the theory that appellant advances here is roughly the same. They will do something to make their boss happy in an effort to curry their favor. It does not fly for the same reason that the court in Van Harken recognized. So, and that's important because let's take a step back. We have a case in which the director recognized the conflict and recused herself. That is the appropriate remedy. What appellant wants to do is essentially impute that conflict to every APJ on the patent trial board. In order to do that, there has to be some basis for these APJs to have a conflict, which turns on their financial theory, which was rejected in Mobility Works, and which is consistent with cases like Van Harken. It's also worth pointing out, to the extent that there's some concern that there would be some impartial evaluation of the merits, these same three APJs wrote the decision on institution well before Kathy Vidal was even nominated. Now, why that does not foreclose a change of their mind in the final written decision, it does at least atmospherically demonstrate that they impartially evaluated the arguments, at least ab initio, and found them to have merit.
Can I just ask you to quickly address, you're accused in the gray brief of making a misleading statement, particularly about whether Ms. Vidal remained lead counsel as opposed to backup counsel. Were you misleading, and if not, why not?
No, the gray brief argument... Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't know.
Sorry. No, in the gray brief, we were simply pointing out that when the reply brief was filed, Kathy Vidal did not sign it. She was still lead counsel technically. She had not formally withdrawn her representation. That's in January of 2022. She withdraws in February of 2022. Although, I hasten to point out, her Judiciary Committee nominations hearing was the day before on January 13th. Per the conversation, for example, that Judge Cunningham had with my friend, you still have to balance your private practice interests with the possibility that your nomination might not
be here. I don't think it's actually the nomination's here. I think it was when she was voted out of committee.
I'm sorry, out of committee.
You make the same point.
Correct. It would be, honestly, under board procedures, I don't think she could have withdrawn before that reply brief was filed because you'd have to seek authorization. So the one-day gap there would have foreclosed it. But she ultimately did withdraw in February 2022 before the final written decision here was offered. I'll offer one more point, Your Honor. And the board relied on this as well, and I apologize because I see I'm over my time. In appendix page 5384, the board pointed out that interim procedures in the PTO clarify that the director does not have any involvement in any final written decision of an IPR, that the director's involvement does not become implicated at least until there's the potential for director review, and by that point, she had recused herself.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's give Mr. Rastegar full 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. As an initial matter, I want to clarify a couple of statements that were just made. UTL is not seeking to bar Micron from all proceedings in the PTO. The issue is this particular proceeding where Director Vidal authored the opinions. That's the only issue we have. We don't have an issue with Micron filing a re-exam.
You just said authored the opinions. I think you misspoke.
No, authored the petitions. I apologize. Thank you. Second of all, this is not an issue of the APJs being inclined to agree with the arguments of Director Vidal's former clients. The issue is, again, that these were Director Vidal's arguments. We've repeatedly heard the test trying to be brought back to, well, there's no evidence that Director Vidal had any involvement in this. There's no evidence that Director Vidal had any sort of communications regarding the final written decisions or any indications about that. That's respectfully not the test. The test is whether the average APJ might be concerned by Director Vidal's prior positions and might be inclined to agree with them. And it's not a test of certainty. We heard reference to the Van Harken case. I think if the court needs to understand why the Van Harken case is not particularly insightful, it simply needs to look at the Aetna case that was cited in the briefing. Aetna was an Alabama state court case where an insured individual sued Aetna claiming the failure to promptly pay various insurance claims. That case went, the plaintiff won at the lowest court and went all the way up to the Alabama Supreme Court where it won 5-4. After that verdict was affirmed, Aetna filed an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court arguing that because the chief judge of the Alabama Supreme Court had filed a separate action against a different insurer, Blue Cross Blue Shield, that involved related issues of law, but not any common issues of fact, all the state employees, including all the judges, were disqualified because they had a potential bias. The Supreme Court ruled that the chief judge in the Alabama court did have a bias. Now, the chief judge in the Alabama court did not stand to make any money from the Aetna case, and he was not suing any of the individuals involved in the Aetna case. Nevertheless, because there were common issues of law, the Supreme Court said, well, there was a potential that that judge might be inclined to make certain rulings of the law that would favor his Blue Cross Blue Shield class action. Now, with respect to the other 8 justices, the Supreme Court said there was no bias, there was no conflict, and the reason for that, among those stated reasons, one of them was expressed. It was there was no evidence in the record that those justices had any idea that they were members of this class action. That's not the case here. Here, the director absolutely was known to be the author of the petitions. And as a result, that necessarily would cause some level of concern that the discretionary aspects of bonus might be subject to negative review if they went against her. We've also heard citation to MobilityWorks as blessing the compensation structure. That's not what MobilityWorks did. MobilityWorks addressed a very specific issue, whether the increased number of decisional units awarded for a final written decision would improperly incentivize an APJ. This court found that because there was no increased decisional units for a final written decision that invalidated claims or a final written decision that upheld all claims, there was not an improper bias. that was not a resounding endorsement of the compensation structure as a whole. It was a very specific issue that was being addressed. Again, we heard multiple comments about, you know, there's no evidence in the record that it would be inappropriate for an APJ to disagree or an APJ to be concerned that they would be punished if they disagreed with Director Vidal. I would respectfully remind the court that the test is not whether there is evidence that that was an explicit threat or something that happened. The test is simply whether or not there was a risk and whether or not there would be a temptation based on that risk that an average man might perceive. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you.
Case is submitted.